Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable as we get started this morning for our roundtable panel. Let me introduce our panel to you. We have a very, great panel. I don't know, this is an exclusive because this incarnation of the panel, these three panelists have never been on together. So that's exciting. We don't know what the dynamic is. That's very exciting. All right. So joining us for the discussion this morning, the voice you just heard, political consultant Libby Post, is with us. Good morning, Libby.
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you here.
Thank you so much.
And you'll be back with us on Monday. You're usually on Monday.
No. Monday, I'm at the Massachusetts Library Association convention.
I did know that.
I'm speaking. So.
All right. We also have with us author, congratulations on that.
Oh, thank you.
Author and activist Barbara Smith is with us each and every Friday, and this Friday no exception. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, everybody.
Thank you very much for being with us. And a man who's been on the program before, but not with me. I was out that day, but publisher and founder of the Empire Report, J.P. Miller, is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to see you. It's nice to meet you. I have to say, generally, I'm 6'5". Generally, I am very intimidated by people who are taller than me because I'm not used to looking up. So what are you, 6'5", 6'6"?
6'5".
Yeah. Okay. So we're just about the same height,
I guess. Just about the same, yeah.
Because I found myself sort of looking up a little bit at you. Don't you find that weird when you see somebody taller?
That's right.
You know, I was thinking about that last night because they talked about him being
6'8".
I was thinking, wow, have I ever been around anybody that tall? Wow.
And being tall, I'm 6'5". When I see someone taller than me, I say, wow, that guy's way too tall.
Right.
That's horrible.
It is. Yeah.
Now everybody you and below is perfect.
Okay. Well, that's good. My brother's 6'9", 6'10", and I find that awkward, but it may just be because he's my brother.
Yeah, but you can take him out, though, so
no,
not to worry.
I don't want to take him out. It's all good. Well, let's get going with what's going on in the world. Man, is anyone else just exhausted by this week news-wise?
Completely.
It's been a lot, so let's keep going. We've got a lot to talk about, and we begin with just what we were talking, really, Jim Comey and the article in the New York Times by Michael Schmidt, who has had a couple great articles this week. President Trump called the FBI Director James Comey weeks after he took office and asked him when federal authorities were going to put out word that Mr. Trump was not personally under investigation, according to two people briefed on the call. So yesterday's article from Michael Schmidt and the story that was in the paper was that he basically, said, hey, what can you do? Let's get out of this
investigation. So let's make a deal.
Let's make a deal, right. And now apparently there were follow-up calls of like, hey, when are you going to do that? When are you going to say I'm not under investigation? Mr. Comey told the president that if he wanted to know details about the Bureau's investigations, he should not contact him directly, but instead follow the proper procedures and have the White House counsel send any inquiries to the Justice Department, according to those people. In one point of this article, they were talking about the hug that was seen and how uncomfortable Comey was with that of being sort of pulled into a hug with the president. It's not that he was really repulsed as much as it was that he felt that the optics of having an FBI director having a relationship with the president like that was improper. Also, he said at one point he just tried to stay away from the conversation and blend in with the curtains.
The drapes of the blue room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought that was weird.
Because he had a blue suit on.
Yeah,
that was
really
so he made you complete camouflage. Yes.
Right.
And as I think both JP and I can tell you, people of our height, it's very hard for us to blend in anywhere.
Well, he is a white guy, so even against the blue, he had a blue suit, but, he was going to stand out.
With all the other white guys in the room?
Right, yeah, he could have just blended in, but he was too tall.
Okay, well, anyway, what do you make of this particular aspect of the story? Do you want to start, Libby?
No, I think we should let our esteemed guest start, because he's not here that much, and I'm here pretty often.
I read the story. I think that Trump in his heart doesn't believe that he's guilty of what people are charging him with. He is a salesman, and I think he was trying to build a relationship with the FBI director. In normal circumstances, a president of the United States trying to build a good relationship with the FBI director wouldn't be seen as a bad thing. I think it would be seen as a positive thing. But because of the ongoing investigation, there is, of course, questions about what he was trying to do with Comey. He was trying to win him over and potentially getting the investigation squashed. and it's great fodder for the New York Times, and it's great fodder for all of us to think about and talk about.
I think it's more than just being a salesman. I think he does think he's innocent because he takes no responsibility for anything he does. So, and we saw that throughout the campaign. But I think more important than that is that he has no idea what it means to be president. And he
That's
has
it.
No clue about the levels of government, the branches of government, the, what the Justice Department does versus the FBI versus Congress. And he just is clueless and stupid about how government works. And so he thinks he can, you know, do the handshake, get the guy, clap him on the back, and he's going to be with him because he's got all this money. And it's just not like he does with business.
And that's one of the points that has been made, is that usually there is not a close relationship
right.
between the president and the head of the FBI for good reasons.
Right.
It was a bad precedent for that to be the case. And I was going to say, as you were speaking, but he doesn't have any statesman-like qualities. If he had statesman-like qualities, him having a polite and civil relationship with any of the people who work for government would be, of course, quite, I think, positive and acceptable. But given that he doesn't have the statesman-like qualities, which is basically what Libby was speaking about, then we have what we have. And, of course, it's in the context of this investigation.
I agree. It does show his lack of interest in the proper protocols of government. And if I was him or advising him, I would want someone else on the phone, someone else advising me on what is appropriate to speak to the FBI director about, and not trying to call the guy directly and being the only person on the phone. I agree with you 100%.
The problem is that he doesn't think he needs anybody's advice. And
right.
that's the, you know, the first step to demagoguery and dictatorship. He thinks he's right all the time. And we're going to slowly, he's going to slowly see that the wheels of justice and steps to democracy will outweigh him and overtake his, what really is a criminality within the presidency and in the White House now. You know, this is Watergate 5.0.
Exactly. I was saying that a week ago or over a week ago, because having lived through the Watergate
mm-hmm.
era
right.
and having been a full-grown adult who was actually working for a major national newspaper at that time, as a book editor, I might add. But it was the summer that...
Yes, it was.
And the newspaper was in Washington,
yeah.
you know. That you know, having lived through that, and as I said, having been fully aware of what went on, I said that was about stealing some files from a Democratic office,
and
Democratic Party office. This is about relationships with our prime.
Right, but this is where the tools have changed.
Enemy.
Files got stolen by the Russians through cyber crime.
Right.
And, you know, and it all circles back
right.
down the drain. So
right.
it's going to be...
Right,
yes, Joe,
indeed,
sorry.
Indeed.
But we're a long way. I tend to stand by many of my colleagues in the media who are very hesitant to talk about impeachment yet, because A, it doesn't seem quite fair, and B, because we're just not there yet. There's still we're putting a lot of carts before a horse, aren't we? Because we've got a long road to go. There's investigations. There's a special counsel. There's a lot to find out. And quite frankly, what is, you know? And I have to say, yesterday, well, the president spoke, and said that. Made the distinction, and I thought it was an important distinction to make, that it was not between the investigation had less to do with him and more to do with his campaign, which is the first time he's really admitted that. And it seems very rational, very possible that this could come in and bring down a lot of people around him, but he could come out of it at least unscathed in an impeachment sense, less so, of course, in the damage politically. JP?
Politically right now, I think he is in Siberia. His staff, he's lost the confidence of his staff, of Congress, of all those people. Legally, I go back to the testimony of James Comey. The past two times that he's been on Capitol Hill, James Comey said there is no evidence that he's found of collusion. Now, that's, of course, a legal definition. The political realities are that Trump has created this you know, really poor scenario of him. He's going to be 5 months in. He has no legislative victories. His staff is on edge. Congress is done with him. His cabinet is done with him. So he has managed this, obviously, extremely poorly. But legally, whether we're at Watergate, I wait to hear what Robert Mueller has to say.
I think he'll resign before we get there. I really do, because he doesn't want to be taken out, you know, in the silver handcuffs. So I think he'll end up resigning because this really, you know, and he'll blame Washington. This really, this quagmire of this politics, I tried to get something done and they just didn't want to listen to me. So I'm going to go back to business.
I can understand the rationale behind that, but seeing him yesterday and even the day before at the Coast Guard Academy,
yes,
and fight, and then also yesterday.
But that's bluster.
Yeah, but that does not seem like a guy who, by all accounts, has a healthy ego to say, okay, I'm gonna leave the job that I started, that my people put me into.
Well, we'll see.
Trump doesn't quit, and he is going to, you're going to love this, Libby. He is the one of the richest guys on the planet. He's one of the most powerful guys on the planet, and he is going to run for re-election as the victim.
Oh, well, he ran for election as the victim.
Right. And this.
Well, he's governing as the victim.
Right.
Yes.
I mean,
and
he won the election, and he's still
a victim.
Yes.
The victim.
The voter fraud by my people and, brown people and,
Right. Yeah,
I'm a black person.
Yeah,
for those of you who are wondering.
Well, people ask.
But I said my people.
Oh, your people.
When Barbara's on,
unlike
people,
my people
ask why don't you have a person of color on? And we have to remind them sometimes that yes, it is radio after all, theater of the mind.
It's radio. Yeah,
it's radio.
We all have faces made for it too.
yes, Libby, I'm painfully aware of that. So he said yesterday, citing this as a witch hunt, he said that both in a morning tweet, but also during a press conference later on in the afternoon. He denied any collusion with Russia, was very forceful in his statement in saying, I respect the move, but the entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians. Zero, he said, and then made the comment that he believes that it's dividing the country in a negative manner.
So I just want to throw in this exclusive report from Reuters, which is that there were 18 contacts between the Trump campaign and Russia that have been previously undisclosed. So this is 18 contacts that were not known. About did you know about that story?
I had heard about that story. My question about that, though, is again, and with the president and JP, I'm interested in what you think about this, because with the president coming out and saying that, he said this several times. Well, I don't know what happened with the campaign, but I know personally I had no relationship. It is. Please do not take this as a defense, but I am just floating a theory that it is quite possible that the people around him were much more involved. I mean, I don't know that if the left can have it both ways and saying, you know, he knew of everything and then also he's very out of touch and they don't even brief the guy.
Well, what I imagine probably happening with Mueller is that Mueller is going to have a bunch of stuff where some staff has had contacts with Russia. There's no smoking gun with Trump, you know, emailing Julian Assange saying, hey, why don't you release the emails this week? And they're going to come out with a report that shows some evidence but nothing chargeable, which is the same thing that happened with Hillary Clinton and her emails, which is evidence of stuff happening but no charges. And so it's going to continue to allow the left to use this as a weapon against him, and it's going to allow the right to say, well, look, no charges, he's innocent, let's move on and talk about something else.
It seems, and correct me if any of you think I'm wrong here, but it seems that Flynn isn't going to come out of this unscathed.
No.
No, he's in trouble. When Jason Chaffetz, who is a right winger, he is a partisan Republican, says what he already knows about what Flynn did is illegal. Michael Flynn, I think, is in big trouble, and Flynn and Manafort are going to be two very tough subjects for the president. Those were two. Those weren't low-level staffers. That was his campaign manager, his national security advisor.
Although he has labeled them. Subsequently, he has labeled them both as very distant to the campaign, even though they were running the campaign.
The man lies. Let's just be honest here. The man is a pathological liar.
I just want to throw it
to
in.
Cover his butt every single time he lies. We cannot trust anything that comes out of his mouth anymore. He's been a proven liar. So, yeah, Paul Manafort, he's going to get me elected. Oh, I really didn't know him. Now it's going to be Steve Bannon. I really didn't know Steve, you know. But I brought him on as the CEO.
Well, when you look at the how this is all unfolding, I find it equally interesting that as we are talking about all of this in the service, there is a great deal of turmoil within the White House. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if that will give us any sign as to where those allegiances are and what happens over the next couple of weeks. I mean, I know the next 9 days he's going to be overseas, but when... what comes out of that when he comes back and some of the dust starts to settle. And even if Comey testifies and with Chaffetz gone, we don't even know if that's somewhat in question of whether that will be done sooner rather than later or if Mueller takes that over. So we have to see, right?
I believe Comey is going to testify next Thursday. And you're right, when you mention the White House staff, to have a White House where the staff is constantly looking over their shoulder and everybody is leaking. You know, I think Trump was in the meeting with the Russian ambassador with two other staffers, and somehow the contents of that meeting gets leaked, and it's the national security advisor. So it is a very difficult position for both the White House staff and for President Trump to be in, where folks aren't trusting each other, folks are leaking to the staff, and the media can get some unnamed sources and get on the front page of the New York Times, and that is what every news outlet is talking about for the entire day. And because of all this,
I'm gonna pause
go
you
ahead.
Just there,
go ahead.
Just for a second, because we have to go to a break. But we'll come back, and then you can be the first one to speak. I promise. We'll be right back. Panel at WAMC.org for your letters. We have a couple. We'll take more right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this morning. Very nice to have you with us. We are thrilled. Our panel is J.P. Miller from Empire Report. We also have Barbara Smith, author and activist, and Libby Post, who is a communications consultant and a regular panelist on this program. We're thrilled to have this trio before us. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to letters in just a second. We'll get to more topics as well. A quick reminder, we have, I think it was Tuesday morning, Malcolm Nance was on the program Tuesday, right? Was on the program Tuesday. And then Wednesday, we announced that we were going to have a special event over at the Linda on June 15th. This is an exclusive Lockbox Premium, and it is a morning panel with Malcolm Nance on Thursday, June 15th from 9 to 10:30. Before that, there'll be breakfast. After that, there'll be a book signing. And for the $100 pledge, the $100, that goes to the Lockbox. What do you get? You get a ticket to the event. You get to see the panel in action. And isn't that worth the price of admission?
Absolutely.
And you get also a lovely breakfast and to meet Malcolm Nance and ask him any questions that you may have. So we are more than halfway through all of the tickets that we had allotted. So they're running out of here. In other words, if you want to go, call now or go online, WAMC.org. If you go onto WAMC.org, right on the front page of the site, there is a box in the right corner. This is tickets for Malcolm Nance. You click on it and we'll just walk you through. $100 a ticket. We would love to have you with us. It's going to be a very special morning. It's definitely going to sell out, so if you want to do it now. It's June 15th. It'll just be a few days after the conclusion of our fund drive, June 15th, Thursday morning, and we would love to have you with us. So WAMC.org, WAMC.org. You can also call the number in the front office, and they will take care of your pledge, which is 1-800-323-9262. 1-800-323-WAMC. There were only 200 tickets available, and we're down to the last 80. So if you want them, and that's only in 2 days. So if you want them, now would be the time to get them, because they will probably be gone by the weekend. So there you go. WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Now, let's get to some letters and we'll move on to some other topics. Roger writes to us and says he doesn't feel he needs anybody else's advice. Doesn't that also describe Obama's modus operandi? So I believe that is a Libby quote regarding the mm-hmm. current president.
And no, actually, Obama had the best and the brightest around him and listened to his advisors and made a decision. That's how the wheels of the presidency should work.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that? No? Okay.
I agree with Libby.
All right. And Richard says, Pence may not have talked to the Russians, but according to Rachel Maddow, he lied about Flynn. Sounds like he is part of a cover-up. What does the panel think about the Mike Pence connection? What do you think, JP?
Again, I go back to it. This is a very challenging environment for people to work in the White House. I think that Trump does get opinions from other people, but whether he follows that is another story. I think sometimes he'll get opinion from someone and then do the exact opposite 10 or 15 minutes later. Mike Pence is in a very tough position, but he seems to me, I've never met him, but he seems like a very honest guy. I think he's giving his honest assessment of what's happening when he's interviewed.
Well, I was watching Rachel Maddow last mm-hmm. night, and I'm not going to be able to absolutely repeat everything that was said. She talks very fast.
Yes, but, she does. Yes, she does.
But the thing is, this is what I gathered from it, which is that when asked directly on several occasions right. in the media, did you know about Mike Flynn's situation?
Right, 3 or 4 times, I think.
And also the fact that... Mike Pence was head of the transition, and that's where the information was coming to. That's, you know, they were informing the transition team, and he said no, he did not. It just seemed very blatant to me.
It's like, who's in charge?
And so they're saying that they think he did know that Flynn had these issues. I can't imagine that they would, and maybe they did. I can't imagine that if they knew that he had these issues, that they would appoint him national security advisor. It's hard to believe, and it happened, but it's hard to believe, right?
Yes and no, considering who the players are. I mean, that's the thing. We're not dealing with the standard set of players. You've got Steve Bannon in the background at that point in time making a lot of these decisions. And his goal is to tear down government. So
yes.
He doesn't have a problem with it. And Pence, I think, is sort of still in shock that they actually got elected. And, what am I going to do now? But he just started PACs for 2018 and 2020. So the writing's clearly on the wall. He knows what's coming down.
I mean, but also Pence was very much a part of the transition. Mm-hmm. We had a reporting... which seems like it was 19 years ago, but I think it may have been last week, which was that President Obama warned
That's
President-elect
right.
Trump about Flynn during their first meeting just 2 days after the election. So you have that, along with the knowledge that they knew he was under, he had told them, as the reporting that we're getting now, that he told them that he was under federal investigation, and that Mike Pence was leading up on him. It seems hard, I agree with you, but it seems hard that he wouldn't have known that.
Yeah.
Going in.
This transition... Every other president that's come in the last 20 years, they've had a robust, serious transition because the person running actually thinks that they have a chance of winning and running the government. The Trump transition was not serious and was not robust. It was run by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. We all know the program with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. And so these guys were not prepared to win. And what happened in the transition on Flynn? I think it's got to go back to he was one of the very few institutional quality generals to endorse Trump early. And Trump said, you know, someone who's there with me early, he has the credentials, I want to keep him around me. He gives me the straight scoop. And unfortunately, the information that he was under investigation or that the Obama administration kind of warned Trump against him did not get the decision made in the right way. You couldn't imagine another presidency where the national security advisor is fired after, I think it was, what, 18 days?
18 days.
In any other presidency, that would be the biggest scandal the first term, and here it's kind of, you know,
another day at the office.
Maybe right. Makes the top 10, right?
And that's the problem. It's another day at the office. And so all of this stuff is going on while they are doing some really nefarious things. But it's like it's governing by crisis, and that's not – it's not like this is the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is a crisis made – of themselves.
I have to say, when Rod Rosenstein went before the senators on Capitol Hill yesterday to speak and talking about and to defend the memo that he sent the president regarding the reasons to fire James Comey, that I did have that feeling like, oh, that was so 19, I mean last Thursday. You know, it just like we're on that from last Thursday, right. But we've had a lot of new stuff in the meantime that we also are going to have to unpack, as they say.
It's a lot to track. It's a lot to keep track of, and I think that they're banking on there's all this stuff going on, and people really aren't going to be watching the consequential actions of this administration.
What do you make? Does anyone think? And I'll bring this up real quick before we go to a break, but. So Jason Chaffetz, I mentioned this earlier, but he's going to leave Congress June 30th. And early reports say that Trey Gowdy of South Carolina is probably going to be re-leading the committee as the next House Oversight Chairman. I'm not usually a conspiratorial person, but what's up with that, do you think, of getting out of town? First of all, saying I'm not going to run again, and then saying, leave. Oh, by the way, my car, the meter's out. I got to go.
Yeah, right.
I'm gone. I'm out of here.
There's something.
There's 1,000% something. And the D.C. media, if the D.C. reporters weren't so consumed with Trump and covering everything that is Trump, It would already be out. There's absolutely something going on with Chaffetz, and time we will find out in time. But this is a guy who loves being a congressman. He's in a big seat of power. He loves being in the media, and he's not just leaving in June because he's kind of sick of it all.
Because they're empty nesters.
The empty nest.
Not true.
Yeah. But I can't even come up with a.
Why do politicians leave office early?
Well, they're either know that the hammer's going to come down, or they're having some sort of illicit affair, or they have a trip on the Appalachian Trail.
Well, that's the illicit affair.
Well, it can be both. Yeah. Right.
I would say that one of those things that you just mentioned is what's going on.
Okay. Do you have any inside information?
I do not.
Okay. All right. Let's take a break. We come back. I have letters. We'll go to those, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel. J.P. Miller is here. Libby Post, Barbara Smith. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We will be back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to our Roundtable Panel for this Friday, the 19th of May, 9:47 on this Friday morning, and we welcome you back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have letters, and we welcome your letters as well, panel at WAMC.org. Ellen writes to us and says, yes, the Russian story matters, but it is overshadowing dire policy proposals such as Sessions' hard line on prosecutions. We're actually going to talk about that a little later. Defunding vital government departments, etc., which will do lasting damage to our country, don't get fully captured by this one issue. Barbara says, I would love to have Pope Francis ask Mr. Trump if he'd use His Holiness as a confessor. Ask Trump to examine his conscience and allow the Pope to hear his confession, as do Catholics routinely. Do you think Trump would even be capable of acknowledging any shortcomings, wrongdoings, dishonorable behavior, even to himself, the Pope, or God, for that matter?
May I say something about that?
Yes. Yes,
although
can.
It's a wonderful scenario to imagine, I would imagine that what Pope Francis would be thinking is, this is above my pay grade.
Yes. Yes. I totally agree with that.
I know I'm Pope, but what did I do to deserve
exactly.
this?
Exactly.
Right. I like the sinners. He doesn't think he's sinned.
Well, maybe he could, maybe that would be his miracle to first sainthood.
Yes, you're right.
That would be great.
That would be great. Saint Francis II.
Yeah, there you go.
That would be some
that would
penance.
Be a miracle. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, that rest. Be a long,
get him
long
into the confessional.
That's
that'd
right.
be that'd be some yeah. confessional session.
Thing.
Keep laughing.
Daisy writes, and this man is representing us overseas. It bothers me to no end. And Jared is doing deals with Lockheed on behalf of the Saudis. Again, we'll bring that up too. All in line to line the future pockets of the Trump empire. It's just so gross. Andy says, got in a bit late. Have you described the Trump base getting very angry at non-Trumpians and acting disruptive? Why? The perceived persecution of Trump. We are not in rational times. Anybody want anything on that? All right. And then Hank takes us to task and says, there is such a naivete on the panel today. It makes me sick, with an exclamation point, I should add. Pence is guilty as hell, with 3 exclamation points, I should note. I don't think anyone here said that he wasn't, right?
Right, no.
or that there were... What
any
we were,
question.
What we were saying is
what's
that,
he guilty of, though?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, I think...
Collusion.
The conversation we were having of knowing the information about Flynn was, I think, the case we were making, right? And talking about being aware and watching what was going on as it was unfolding.
Yeah, I think Pence is at heart. All right, you can make the case Trump is a dishonest guy. Fair point. Pence, I don't see him as a dishonest guy. I also don't see him putting his neck out on the line for Trump, because I don't know that Trump would do the same for him. I just don't see it. So, I think that they're two very separate actors.
I tend to agree with you. My question is, though, it does seem that, especially being part of the transition, and if the reporting is true about knowing about Flynn and then going back and firing Flynn because he didn't tell certain particular things to Pence, that seems like a harder argument to buy if indeed they knew it going in.
Well, that would, I think, be reasonable looking at a normal transition. But I think that if you were to watch this transition, it was anything but a normal transition.
I can't argue with that. Okay. I'll give you that. All right. Let's go back. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I get what you're saying, that you think he's an honorable guy or whatever. But his politics, he wants to put me on an island somewhere.
Yeah,
he believes
you and me,
in
both
right,
of us.
Right,
yeah, we
right,
did it together.
Right, right. We would. We could make a lovely house together. Mm-hmm, but he believes in reparative therapy. He believes that gay people are, you know, the devil's playhouse.
I still want to go to your guy's island.
Yeah,
that's
I know.
So
it's
great.
It'll be fabulous. Are you kidding? It'll be absolutely fabulous.
Will you invite me to the island?
Right. But
he
is. But
we might not have many resources.
Right.
That's
right,
the thing.
Yeah. But he is politically, I mean, he is horrible. He's anti-choice. He, you know, he believes that men can't control their own sexual urges. So he's got to take his wife everywhere with him. Otherwise, if he's alone in the room with a woman, oh my God, he might attack her. You know, he can't control himself. So, you know, honorable, is he lying for Trump? Who knows? Will that wait to come out? But to have this man be in the seat in the Oval Office is just as dangerous, if
no,
not
more. No, it's
more
frightening. And I said that from the point that he was selected as the vice presidential nominee.
Yeah, to bring in the right.
Because he is a hard right ideologue.
Okay,
I mean,
we have dealt with hard right ideologues before in our past, and we have not been in the turmoil that we are in currently.
Are you talking about as president, though? Which presidents
well,
are you
we
speaking
have, well,
of?
Well, what I'm talking about is the fact that while I agree with you certainly on the politics and the concern over that far-right element, especially for many of, or not all of, the issues that we talk about in this program. However, the man does seem to have a conscience. He does seem to he does seem to be aware of what he knows and what he doesn't know. And in comparison, I'm not making a case for the guy. All I'm saying is that I do think you would eliminate, if he were to take over, which I
you'll
again
eliminate.
I still think I think you would eliminate the complete chaos.
No, he
that
knows how to
in.
Run a government.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
He has experience. Right. He has run a state. He has government experience, and I think things would be changed. And if that, I don't know. I guess where I'm having some problems is of whether that's worse.
So
I don't know that we'd all be looking at our phones every day saying, oh, my God, is our planet still here? I don't know if we would
be
doing
it wouldn't
that.
Yeah, it wouldn't be high crimes and misdemeanors. But this is something that I remember reading during the campaign, which is that one of the things that was put into place in Indiana is that if a same-gender couple applied for a marriage license, they had a law that if you said anything on that form that was not true, that you could be prosecuted and even jailed. So the application had only checkoffs for a male and a female. So if you were two women or two men and you put your names on the application, everything else was correct, but there's no space for two women, there's no space for two men, that you could indeed be prosecuted for having lied on the form. That's Mike Pence. So.
Yeah, I don't, to say that he has a conscience, I think that's going a little too far. The man sees the world through typical right-wing Christian white male perspective, and that everyone who is not fitting into that guideline is the other. And
I agree with his conscience, but I think he has a conscience.
I don't know. If he had a conscience, why would he still be in the White House knowing what he knows? Knowing that this man cannot lead the country. You know, people are, and the other part of this is that
he may also have ambition.
Well, he does have ambition. He wants to be president. What we will, if Trump leaves and he becomes president, we will no longer have the cult of personality that we have in the White House, but we will have a much more dangerous person who understands how government works and knows which levers to push to be more repressive.
Right. You see the Democrats have, I think, actively quieted down, and I've read articles about this, quieted down on the impeachment front because they are nervous about getting rid of Trump too early and then having Mike Pence, who is a capable operative, it would be a capable governor of the country, coming in with a Republican House and a Republican Senate, mm-hmm. and actually passing legislation that the American people voted for in 2016, instead of being constantly subsumed with the tabloid scandals and controversy that we're experiencing now.
His Muslim ban would hold water in court. His Health Care Act would dot all the I's and cross all the T's. That's what we're talking about. And as I said, I was saying that from the very beginning of his being the person, mm-hmm. the second person.
All right. Let us go to a couple of things that we have about a minute before we go to a break. But there is, as we look at the foreign trip that's taking place, we spoke about this at length yesterday, but I'm interested in what the three of you think of what we make of this trip, because I think we've set the bar now. We just don't want there to be some sort of disaster. But also, you also have to look at it and say, okay, but what can we accomplish through a trip like this?
I think it's actually, I don't think Trump, or what I read is that Trump is not excited about this trip. I actually think for him politically and for the media environment right now, it's an opportunity for a reset for him. And a palate cleanser. And Trump is good on the human aspect. You see him go to Jimmy Fallon. He does a great job on Jimmy Fallon, The Tonight Show. If he has some funny or endearing interaction with the Pope or with some foreign leader, you remember when George Bush tried to open open the door and he couldn't, and that was kind of a gag.
Yeah,
it's a possibility for a reset.
Do you think the Pope should wrestle his hair?
That would be awesome if that happened. But and of course he could of course make a bunch of gaffes and make it into a huge negative story. That's well within his realm of possibility. But it's also a potential for a reset in terms of the media and the narrative going forward.
I'm not saying I'm not going to enjoy it, but I said this yesterday and I'll say it again today, which is, but also the media is just waiting to pounce, right? They're waiting for anything that is going to be perceived as a gaffe.
Well, the media right now, in who we're talking about, is CNN and MSNBC now are the top two cable networks. They are beating Fox News, and it is a business for them to beat up on Trump, just like when Obama was in office, it was a business for Fox News to beat up on Obama. And the media is going to continue to beat up on him because it's business. It's they're getting paid on it. This is what they're doing, and they will not stop even if he does have a good couple weeks.
And sometimes it can be funny. Yes. Okay, let's take a break. We're going to go to look. Ray's there. He's in his natural habitat, ready to do news. We'll be right back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. J.P. Miller is here from Empire Report. Barbara Smith is with us, author and activist. And we have Libby Post on the program as well. She is a communications consultant. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Have some letters and then we'll move on to some other topics to round out the program in our final segment this morning. Eric writes, I love and respect Joe to the end. Thank you.
The end of
but,
what?
But you know the butt's coming, right? Okay, but anyone who would put Libby, Barbara, and I on an island does not have a conscience. Conscience being an awareness of right and wrong. Pence has no conscience. Love the panel and WAMC as always. The point I was making, just to be clear, is that he has his conscience, and I he is looking at a lens through a religious perspective and ideology. And I think that it is I agree that it's reprehensible, but I still think he feels that there is a goodness that he is doing for people versus what we are seeing. I was using it as an example.
He's doing
versus Trump.
He's doing God's work.
Exactly.
That's what he
as he defines.
Doing.
As he defines that.
Mm-hmm. And that was the point I was trying to make. Not I'm certainly
whereas
not
the other
him.
One doesn't really
the,
operate
the president.
That way.
Exactly. Yes. That was all I was trying to say. Okay, thank you. Gary writes, Pence will be much more dangerous as president than Trump. He actually has a horrible policy agenda and will be able to work with Congress to make it real. I don't see Pence's conscience. Where is that? No one can tell another's conscience. He ran on a platform with Trump. Conscience? He thought he would be president eventually, and Trump was his ticket. Well, I think he may still think that, right? I don't think that has gone away. Stacy says Pence had a chance to stand up for morality during the campaign when the Access Hollywood tape surfaced. He is an opportunist and far more dangerous than Trump because he has convinced people he is a stand-up guy, i.e. a good Christian. Kristen says during the vice presidential debate, Pence repeatedly denied that Trump had certain shocking things after the debate. Numerous video clips revealed that Trump had indeed said exactly those things that showed me that Pence is absolutely prepared to lie for Trump or lie to save face. John Weiss writes in and says, I don't know who this is from. John says, my husband refers to Mike Pence as a Christian supremacist. We're a same-sex couple, by the way, so we'd be on the island with Barbara and Libby.
And they would do all the good things that we need done. Cooking, decorating.
Got to put them to work.
It would be fabulous. Just all right. Fabulous.
All right. Let's go to other topics this morning and find out what else is going on. Again, it's hard to know sometimes where we're going to end up, but we'll go with the Jared Kushner story. A $110 billion weapon sale to the Saudis has Jared Kushner's personal touch. Here's the story as reported by the New York Times. On the afternoon of May 1st, President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner welcomed a high-level delegation of Saudis to a gilded reception room next door to the White House and delivered a brisk pep talk, "Let's get this done today." Mr. Kushner was referring to a $100 billion plus arms deal that the administration hoped to seal with Saudi Arabia in time to announce it during Mr. Trump's visit to the kingdom this weekend. The two sides discussed a shopping list that includes planes, ships, and precision-guided bombs. Then an American official raised the idea of the Saudis buying a sophisticated radar system designed to shoot down ballistic missiles. Sensing that the cost might be a problem, several administration officials said Mr. Kushner picked up the phone and called Marilyn Hewson. She, you will remember, is the CEO of Lockheed Martin, which makes the radar system, and asked her whether she could cut the price as his guest watched slack-jawed. Ms. Hewson told him that she would look into it, according to the officials. So this is a personal intervention. The White House and Lockheed declined to comment on the call between Mr. Kushner or on a broader arms sale. And it is also, I wanted to get to the point where officials emphasized that Mr. Kushner's work on the deal was part of a government-wide effort that includes the State Department, the Defense Department, and the National Security Council. They also said the arms sale would only be one element of Mr. Trump's busy two-day stop in Saudi Arabia. And also, again, nothing illegal about that. We should point out.
Well, I think when I read this, I was like blown away, and we're all kind of, if you could see our expressions, we're all kind of like, yeah, we would have been slack-jawed too. But I think it just highlights the confusing mix of government and business and corporate and backslapping deal-making.
Right.
It was just an incredible example.
Yeah, I mean, look, I when I'm with a client and something needs to get done, I'll make a phone call. But it's business, and it's not government contracts.
Right.
It's a different thing. And he did this as a power play to show he had the ability to make that phone call and how powerful he was. That's really all that was about. And who knows if it's gonna work or not? We don't know if they're gonna bring the price down, because they already brought the price down for his father-in-law at the beginning of the presidency when he complained that some plane was too expensive.
Well, I think when you are Saudi Arabia and you're buying arms from Lockheed Martin, I believe that you have to do that in conjunction with the United States government. And right. And when Lockheed Martin sells arms to Saudi Arabia, they're making an insane amount of profit. They're not selling, rice where everybody knows what the price of rice is. They're selling these highly sophisticated arms. They're selling it for $100 billion. They're going to make an insane amount of profit. The government, I imagine, helps negotiate the price with Saudi Arabia. I don't know that for a fact, but I imagine they do. Whether it's appropriate for Kushner to make that call from the White House in front of the Saudis, probably not appropriate.
One would think the Defense Department would have something to say about it.
So you're saying don't pay the sticker price on the missile?
Definitely not.
Okay.
Never.
Right.
Never. Well, and
just
and
like
the other thing, he's not selling it to like a country who's worried about, they don't have enough money and they need to protect their country and they're poor. This is Saudi Arabia. Nobody has more money than Saudi Arabia. But and so you're getting the top price plus.
But we do I agree with Libby, but again, there is legally nothing wrong with it, but it does seem like a move that you do to
impress. It's all about impressing the client.
Yes.
That's all it was. I mean, I don't know if he really has the statutory ability to cut the deal.
Not to cut the deal, but you can bring the price down, right?
Yeah,
you can work on it.
Well, but still, does he have that ability?
He has the phone number in his cell phone.
But legally, does he have the ability to make this call as a special advisor?
I don't know.
Right.
I mean,
is the Defense Department having a coronary about this, the Secretary of Defense and everybody else who's involved? So it really was.
You said, are they or they are?
No, are they? Are they?
Okay.
We
don't know.
I mean, we don't know. But it's a power play.
All right. I also want to get to this story in Tulsa. A white Tulsa officer is acquitted in the fatal shooting of a black driver. This was sort of the latest one of these stories. Jurors on Wednesday found a white police officer not guilty in the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man last year, one in a string of law enforcement killings of black men that have prompted a national debate about race relations and the use of force. Like several other recent cases, the trial of Officer Betty Jo Shelby and the death of Terrence Crutcher demonstrated both the increased pressure to hold officers responsible for using lethal force and the difficulty of convicting them of a crime. The Tulsa County District Court jury of 8 women and 4 men, including at least 4 black jurors, deliberated for about 9 hours before finding Officer Shelby not guilty of manslaughter. Shannon McMurray, Officer Shelby's lawyer, said late Wednesday that her client was overwhelmed and would make a full statement in the morning. She is elated. Ms. McMurray said, "We all are. It is a true and just verdict."
And the grandfather of Terrence Crutcher's children talked about how there are 4 children at home who don't have a father. I don't think that people can fully understand. I've said this on this air a number of times now. I don't think people understand. So sorry to be hoarse. What it feels like to live in a country where black people are dispatched with so little consequences. And when the trials happen, if they're even brought to trial, people are exonerated and, without consequence. This is maybe switching gears, but I'm really, I've never had a chance, I think, to talk about the recent murder of the teenage boy in Dallas, Jordan Edwards, who was leaving a party mm-hmm. with his brothers, and the police officer felt the need to shoot into the car. And to me, that just epitomizes the situation that we as black people find ourselves in this country and have found ourselves in from time out of mind. That officer didn't think, these are kids, you know, these could be my sons. They're leaving the party. They're not posing any threat to me. If I shoot into this car willy-nilly, I'm destroying not only the life of the person in the car, but everybody else. These brothers saw their brother murdered. This family has lost what seems like the most wonderful child you can imagine. You know, great grades, honor student, great athlete, kind, nice. And then you look at his picture, you know. So maybe that's switching gears. I just feel that we have a really broken system. And what really bothers me is that we're now in a political mm-hmm. context and paradigm where these kinds of issues do not matter. Jeffrey Beauregard Sessions has nullified the processes of where police departments were under consent decrees or what amounts to consent decrees on the federal level from the Justice Department. He has rescinded all of that. And what he's interested in, as we mentioned earlier in the show, is putting people in prison for forever for smoking a joint, whereas those are either for doing crack, whereas those who are using powder cocaine in the suburbs are walking around scot-free. So I have a lot of all the feelings about this.
The latest in that Jordan Edwards story, too, is that the family and the other kids that were in that car are saying, I believe his stepbrother, Vidal Allen, said that he heard the cops use the N-word before cuffing the teenagers. This was moments after the officer fatally shot the student in the head. And again, I mean, you hear these stories and you get criticized when you say things like that, but you got this kid. First of all, it's a kid, number one. But number two, the kid is an honor student. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got an incredible future ahead of him.
Yes,
and not that if he didn't would make it any less horrific, but it does put it into a context. But going back to the case, just for a moment, going back to the case that we were talking about
yes.
before. Of why the juries, and especially in a jury where you have four black jurors on that panel, and the officer is charged with first degree manslaughter, and they ultimately find her to be not guilty.
And see, that's the thing too about the criminal justice system: the charging, the training of the police officer. I think it said that she was following her training. Mm-hmm. And these are split second decisions. the context is such that that's the way, given the logic of the system, of the legal system, probably the jurors followed the logic of the legal system.
But the juror,
even though they were black.
Yeah, the thing is, though, is that it's this split second decision and following their training. We don't see this happening to white motorists. We just don't.
Well, that gets to what you were saying, though, Barbara, doesn't it? I mean, that's part of the system. Right. That's what's ingrained within the system.
It's an open season on anyone who isn't white and straight.
Yeah, well, and we're considered to be criminal types.
That's right.
Yeah, we're
criminal. Right.
I
watched the video this morning. Yeah, it's a little grainy, but he was walking with his hands up and walking towards the car. And there was some guy who said, well, he's probably a big, bad dude or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. They had already made up their mind that this guy was of the criminal element. And because of that, he doesn't deserve to live. And so they shot him. I mean, my thing is, okay, was he grabbing for something? Nobody knows. Shoot him in the leg. Disable the guy.
Well, that's not right.
It's shoot to kill. Shoot him in the leg. Shoot him someplace else. Make sure he goes down. But you don't have to kill him. You just don't. But they want to do that, and it's another notch in the belt. I mean, I know we'll get letters for that.
It really is sad, and there are certainly bad police officers. But I think that a police officer shooting an unarmed person has to be the toughest thing that they go through, and it's a very tough decision for them to do that. And I don't think most of them want to do it. I don't think they consider it a notch in their belt. I think that they are put in a tough situation, and they make that decision, and it's really bad. And of course, there are bad cops that should be locked up, but the majority of police officers are there to help protect and serve the community, and that's what they do.
I agree, and we need our police. And I don't think anybody would disagree that we need our police departments and law enforcement. We want them there when we need them. But to shoot into a car of unarmed black youth, that's uncalled for. To shoot a guy who's got his hands up.
Who were going away from the officers. Right. They weren't coming toward the officers. Right. They lied when they described what had happened.
They said this car
was posing a threat to
them. We have the guy in I think it was South Carolina who was running away from the cop, and the cop shot him in the back.
So that's two. Just we have about 2 minutes left, and I just want to get to this point. You both just brought it up. A line in this article stood out to me, which is the last 3 years have brought intense protests over lethal use of force by law enforcement and mounting police pressure to punish officers, particularly when race is a factor. Video recordings offer grounds to second guess the police. However, convictions remain unusual. Why do those videos affect us in such a way and yet do not affect a jury in the same way?
Sentencing guidelines, procedures, that's what I was saying, that when, we don't know all the details of, are you an attorney?
No.
So none of us are. Just want to be clear or sure about that. But the thing is, we don't know all the jury instructions and the things that jurors are told and what is allowable within the context of the charges, et cetera. That's why I talked about the systems, the training of the officers. That's a part of our criminal justice system. The charge to the jury and the instructions to the jury, that's a part of the system. What you can allow and not allow, all those things have to be examined in order for us to have some different results. And then, of course, there is the issue of racism and white supremacy, which will take a lot longer to solve. But the Justice Department during the previous administration actually did acknowledge that there was such a thing as implicit bias and explicit bias, and that racial attitudes indeed did have a disproportionate impact upon negative outcomes in the context of policing and criminal justice. They actually acknowledge that. The one who's in there now, that's a non-starter. He would never acknowledge that.
The one thing that I find really interesting in all this is the NYPD right now, New York City has the record low crime rate, and that is not the case in places like Chicago. And it's fascinating that these police forces don't kind of get best practices. Not that everybody should learn from the NYPD, but it's an amazing study as to why there's record low crime in New York City and not elsewhere, and why don't these other police forces implement the best practices of the NYPD. Not that they haven't had their issues themselves, but
And I had to say the Albany Police Department has also been recognized similarly because of the commitment to community policing and efforts to change that very, very strained and fraught relationship mm-hmm. between communities of color and the police. I was a part of that effort as a member of our common council, so I know a little bit of inside
and
baseball
it works.
On it.
Yeah. It works when people work together.
We're going to hold it there for this program and for this week, and who knows what next week will bring. Well, we'll see. Stay tuned. It'll all be quite a ride. Libby Post, Barbara Smith, J.P. Miller, thank you very much for being with us. I hope you have a lovely weekend. Very nice to have you here this morning.